Isn't it interesting that it ends with me after conversations about retiring? Last year at age 75, I decided 55 years working for the man was enough. Started my own consulting practice, working with professional service firms as a resource and connector, and I do a little investing.
Al, I don't think you, in fact, are the last. Please.
I'm Diane Frankenfield. I am working with Larry, and most recently was head of marketing at Oppenheimer. Now, searching in the Boston area.
And the two people standing here behind me are?
Barry Steigl, and we do career management, leadership development, retain search.
And I'm Mary Peabody. We also do board options, working with boards of directors, particularly nominating governance committees and board self-governance.
Well, today we have, as our leader for this group, David Martin. I asked David about this earlier. I noticed that he was introduced to me by Larry on my cheat sheet here as David X. Martin. And I said, is that because Larry does not know his middle name? And it turns out the reason is, as David said, he doesn't have a middle name. But John Reed at Citicorp, where he spent some time, tried to find him in the Citicorp directory, and there were too many David Martins. He said, you've got to have a middle initial. Choose one. So he chose X. So that is truly his middle initial. I just want you to know that he's talking today about risk management and how to overcome a board impatience with that topic. But let's talk a little bit more about David. He was the founding chairman of the Investment Company Institute's Risk Management and co-chair of the Buy-Side Risk Committee, composed of chief risk officers of the 20 largest asset management firms. Also does some teaching as an adjunct at the Stern School of Business in NYU. David has written some things. He's written The Risk and the Smart Investor and the author of The Nature of Risk. He's also published a number of white papers on compliance and risk and so forth. I would like to say that also while at AllianceBernstein, he served as chief risk officer and director of Sanford Bernstein LLC. He was responsible for the oversight of $875 billion in assets. I think that's nearly a trillion. And was a member of the firm's committee on valuation, ethics, internal controls, and more and more and more. David is a certified public accountant and has an MBA from New York University. David is going to get a chance to speak in a very few minutes, but I would like to say that we're going to be working here until 6 o'clock together, and then about 10 minutes before our deadline, I'll give us all a warning, and then we'll come to a soft landing at 6 o'clock, and you're welcome to stay on and discuss, but those who need to leave certainly can at that time. I think that's all I have to say, and that may have been even too much. David?
Warren, thank you for the intro. I'm delighted to be here. I actually just got off a plane from Lima, Peru, which is one of the cases that we're going to talk about tonight. So what I've done is prepare 4 cases, and this is the board, and we're having this board meeting tonight. And you can say anything at any time, ask any question, interject, and what I really want to do is have a conversation, and out of that conversation, tease out, you know, what are the important issues with respect to risk, and how do you make risk real and less boring. So with that, we're going to start with the 4th case. So if you look in your packets, 4th case, and each one of these cases I have been intimately involved with. So here's case number 4. We're going to call this emerging risks. So you have a company that it gets tagged. Every time something comes along, you hear about them, they have some exposure to it. They claim, hey, we're big, we're large, you know, we're just gonna get hit. The committee, the board talks to all the people, the senior management, everybody says, hey, everything's working fine. Don't worry about it. You know, risk comes around and produces these highly technical reports. No one has a clue what they're talking about, right? But they've got reams and reams of paper, and they seem to feel very comfortable about it. CEO comes before the board and says, hey, nothing to worry about, okay? But the board itself feels that it's not comfortable. It doesn't feel that they have their arms around all the risks. They don't have a sense that they're gonna, you know, get away from this. And here we are at the board meeting. First question, what are the right questions to ask? What do you think? Peter.
Oh, that's hard. I don't know.
Okay, Joe, you were a chief risk officer, State Street. What
I
would you
say? I never answer any questions.
You know. Okay, I'll ask some questions. Let's go.
The simple one is, what could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
I mean, what could be the downside here? It may look stable, it may look clean. What could go wrong?
Okay, so if we think about that question, which is a very good question, what could go wrong? How do we come to...
Well, I would add something. I agree that Charlie has brought up something interesting, but I think to take it one step further, you would probably want to develop some likely scenarios.
Ah, what are scenarios?
Situations that strategists, senior decision makers, etc., would agree that have some likelihood of occurring. You know, to use Byron Wien's shorthand, at least a 50-50 probability in the next 12 months. That would be a surprise, either some sort of an upside surprise that we're not prepared for and can't capitalize on, or a downside surprise that we can't recover from elegantly.
So interesting you talk about scenarios. The most famous literature on scenarios was written by a guy by the name of Peter Walk. Peter Walk wrote two Harvard Business Review articles in the 80s and 90s. He worked for, I think it was Gulf Oil, and he predicted two oil crises. Now he had most people don't notice, but he had a guru that he went to in Florida when he went on vacation. And the way they thought about it was that there was some level of consciousness that you had when you had focus. So for example, if you took a rock and you threw it at a tree and it made a noise, and then you closed your eyes and thought about the tree and threw the rock, somehow you would have better accuracy because you had a sense of what you were looking for, what you were trying to do. So they came up with this idea of scenarios. Scenarios are like stories. And they really tried to, Chinese menu style, come to grips with what the potential stories are. Okay. Now, once you have the story, okay, if you look at the White House Situation Room, what they use trips. They say, they call them tripwires. So basically what happens, you have this story, and then it has to play out, and you have these trips, so that if something happens and the story changes, you don't get lulled into just keep on going along. So let's talk about, you raised the question.
I will.
Now you will.
I just finished reading it.
So. Okay. Okay.
I think the thing that jumped out at me is the phrase of acceptable risk.
Uh-huh.
And therefore they made some assumption about what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. And my first question really has to do with that, what is it that we really don't know?
Okay.
Because you already defined it here, right? You say, what is the, in order to think about risk appetite, you have to think about, you know, how big is, what are the things that's coming? So what is it that, and if I was sitting in the room, whether or not my board is right or wrong, they would ask me, Joe, what do you worry about?
We're going to come back. We'll come back to how you figure out what emerging risks. But you talk about risk appetite. So let me ask you a question. A CEO of a company in Germany, it's late at night, it's wet, it's raining cats and dogs, and he could make one telephone call. And he calls up his CRO, and he says, on autobahn you can go as fast as you want. How fast should I drive this automobile tonight? And the CRO answers with one question: what is your risk appetite? Okay, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does it mean, your risk appetite? Okay, so first of all, hold on. We have emerging risks. We got to talk about how you get to that. And then we have a sense of, what's your appetite for this? Okay, so let's talk about emerging risk first, and then we'll get back to appetite, because they're both very interesting. How do you, and we talked about scenarios, about thinking about the future. Let's go around, let's think about, what are the emerging risks out there today that we could have a discussion about? Does anybody think of an emerging risk? Can anybody?
Yes, political.
What?
Political.
What sense?
Political, the Middle East mess.
Okay.
Spreads worldwide.
Okay, but how does that relate to our company? Let's.
If you're doing business in China, there's a political situation that erupts and your market is suddenly disrupted.
Do you think that the, so if we would look at China.
Or your supply chain.
We would look at China, okay, and you just made a point and said there's a political risk in China, and we would try to think about that risk going forward, right? How would we assess the political risk in China? Let's say we have a company, we have a supply chain, as you say, we're doing business in China. What would disrupt that? Let's just throw some ideas out. Tiananmen, right? Tiananmen Square. Would the Chinese ever let that happen again?
They're pretty focused on not allowing that to happen again.
Focused on not allowing that. Did they just have a new plenarium where they try to do some emerging things?
I don't think that the Chinese actually knew that was going to happen before.
Knew what was going to happen before? Tiananmen, right. Right, but they're very scared of that happening again, right? They want this political stability. Do you think the Chinese government would allow for political instability? So do you think that's a real risk? Okay, so let's take a step back. How do we define risk? How do we think about risk? What is risk? Come on, board. What is risk?
Risk is volatility.
Volatility.
I think of it as the statistical likelihood of certain outcomes.
Statistical likelihood of some outcomes.
So if I think about currency risk, for example, mm-hmm. and I think about the likelihood that a certain currency will fluctuate plus mm-hmm. or minus a certain percent over a certain amount of time, I was mm-hmm. thinking those mm-hmm. terms.
Anybody else?
Roderick, to find it a little more broadly.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's something that disables your plan.
Okay, disruptive force, a disruptive force.
To say it's beyond the bounds of sort of prescribed behavior.
Okay.
Right? Your plan,
out of bounds. Out of bounds. Volatility.
It doesn't have to be negative.
Yeah. No. So let me tell you how I think about
it.
Let me tell you how I think about it. Okay. Very simply, risk is the absence of information. As you go through life, you knew that?
I knew that.
Because we spoke about it, right? but as you go through life, you're always going to be confronted with an absence of information. And that absence of information creates risk, right? And the whole idea, and there's nothing wrong with risk. I mean, I'm a Walter Wriston trained risk manager. Risk is a four-letter word. There's nothing wrong with it. You can't have return unless you have risk. So you have to manage the risk, okay? So now we've defined risk. Now let's talk about emerging risks, okay? What are those things out there that could disrupt things? So let's talk about, let's do a simple one. Let's take a look at the economy, okay? What has happened over the last year or two? What have governments done to prop up the economies? Quantitative easing, right? Now what are they doing?
They're pulling
back a little bit, right?
Trying to.
Now, I want to ask you a question. Have anyone ever had a large portfolio that you had to liquidate? Did you ever have a large portfolio that you had to liquidate?
What
right.
portfolio?
A marketable securities. Did you ever get out without having large losses? Right. So think about this. You have Japan. Okay. What's the risk in Japan? They're doing all this quantitative easing. Right. What's the risk? Two risks. One, the confidence goes away. They can't sell more bonds. And two, they're so successful that they have huge inflation, right? Just the opposite of what you would think. So
there's... people still don't spend.
Oh, and people still don't spend. Okay, and it doesn't work. That's the other side of it, right? But what I'm trying to show you is that there's... you have to think through the implications of these things and think things, what could disrupt what you're going to do. As a board, you want to go into the meeting and say, okay, you have a strategy. You're depending on certain things. What if those things don't happen? Nothing is straight line. So you now what do I do to figure out about emerging risks? I talk to dissidents. dissidents always have a kernel of truth in what they say. Okay, they may be far ahead, but I try to tease out, you know, what's going to be there. And I create scenarios, and I think through how things could possibly work. So what are the things that I've been thinking about? Cybersecurity. Okay, huge risk, right? Nobody really, I mean, it's not, you know, you have bad actors, okay? But what is the real risk? It's insider risk. People on the inside that go ahead and give away your information or have the keys to the kingdom, right? So cybersecurity is a big issue, okay? All this indebtedness is a big issue, okay? Let's take another one, oil. Let's just throw that out. How do we think about oil? I mean, if you're a company that's in the refining business, what would you think about in terms of oil? How would you look at it? You want to look at supply, you want to look at demand. Okay, you look at supply, you look at shale, you see all this new energy coming on stream. You look at the economy and you see what the demand is. But the point is that you start dissecting it. You start thinking about these emerging risks. You're not looking behind you, you're looking ahead of you. So as a board, you come back and say, okay, have you thought about, we go back to this company. Tell me, what are the emerging risks that you have coming that you feel so comfortable? That's the questions that you ask, you know. Now, how should they get you comfortable? How should the CEO come back? If you were on the board of JP Morgan and Jamie Dimon walked into the room, what would you say to him? Besides the fact that you just got a $20 million raise, and you know, and you paid out, you know, X amount. But what would you say to him in terms of how are we going to get this? How are we covered? What would you ask him? How would he make you? How would you want him to make you feel comfortable? What would you say?
That the assets of the firm are substantially diversified, so that no one individual risk can take the entire company down.
So you're saying that there's no big.
Both the positive and the negative risk. So
your point is diversification. There's no big risk out there, and that we should be okay. But if we get hit by little things,
you're playing both sides of the gamble as well.
So you would feel comfortable. You would feel comfortable if he had if he could say to you, look, my portfolio is such that it's so diversified that at the end of the day, it's not going to really have an impact. Would you feel comfortable with that? Brian, would you feel comfortable with that?
No.
Okay.
For instance, in this case, you know, even though they have 30% market share in Hong Kong, it's only 2% of the overall corporation. So if they lose this entity.
Oh, that's the other case. We're on case four. Okay.
Oh, you're on four.
Okay.
You're on one.
Okay. So let me tell you what I would do. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
I would want to see a full risk management plan to see how comprehensive it is.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Here we go.
What areas it covers and what areas it doesn't cover.
How did you think about the future, these emerging risks? Okay. What were your tripwires that you put in place? What was the strategic impact of these things? How would it affect our strategy? And what are the action plans? What are you going to do if these things happen? You know, like a military plan. What are you going to do? Let's know exactly what we're going to do. Okay? Yes.
Mentioning Jamie Dimon brings up, I think, a very interesting additional risk. Which is to say, the substance of the risks may be quite different from how those risks will kind of resonate in other areas. For instance, what I'm thinking of is the outright losses from closing out the London whale positions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was somewhere in the third significant digit after the decimal point,
right,
in terms of share earnings. It was absolutely immaterial. However, you know, they had been put in a position by the government to be a bad guy. So now you have a match that's thrown into the kindling, and while the event is immaterial, the consequences of the event are very bad.
Okay, so let me take that issue up, which gets back to another issue that was raised before. How high is up? Okay? We've been hit by it. We're in case four. We're going to go to case one. as a subset of case four. You have case one, you're in Hong Kong, okay, Chinese are taking over Hong Kong. You have a $200 million after-tax portfolio. It's 3% of the company's net income. You send out a guy, they sent me out, comes back and says, listen, hey, it's going to be a nonviolent takeover. What kind of loss number should we be looking at that we don't want to have? And if we come up with that loss number, we can then build a portfolio around it to know that, you know, this is it. First question is, what are the strategic implications of doing this? What is the strategic implications of this? Okay, we'll take it one. What is the loss amount? What's your risk appetite, as you said? Two, and what is the strategy? What happens as a result of this?
Well, I think in the case of something that's in Asia, the question is, you've got a great position in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
What about the rest of Asia? If you were to lose your Hong Kong position, would that affect your business?
Okay, so that's a knock-on effect, right? If you get blown up out of Hong Kong, how does that affect you in the rest of the Middle East, Far East? Okay.
Or vice versa.
But how much
you
money?
Pull back your horns in Hong Kong.
Right.
What would the rest of your businesses in Asia start?
What about Hong Kong? What if I'm having a growth, it's a really great growth business for me, and if I restrain the portfolio, I'm going to lose market share, and I have dominant share now. How do I think about that? And how do I balance that against how much money how much risk I'm willing to take? Now, no one has talked to me about how much risk are we willing to take, board. Tell me. How much risk?
Well, in a situation where it's not material to the overall earnings profile, I think you can take a lot of risk.
So tell me how much.
I think you let them go.
What does that mean, let them go?
I mean,
take $1 billion, we'll take $1 billion on the chin, let them go? Take $2 billion on the chin?
Well, the question is, what's your downside?
Well,
it doesn't look like it is $1 billion.
You have all the material that you need to know. You know that you make $200 million. You know it's 3%. You know we have a dominant position, 30% share. How much loss are we willing, how much risk are we willing to take if the Chinese come in and blow this thing up?
You lose a couple $100 million.
Oh, so you're willing to lose how much? Give me a number.
Well, if 200 million is 2% of the total,
3%.
So it's 3% of the total bottom line. So you're I can't do math anymore.
$2 billion.
$2 billion bottom line.
Right.
The answer is I'm willing to go for $500 million to $1 billion.
Give me a number.
Billion.
$1 billion.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else have a number? Joe.
Don't have a number.
You don't have a number.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it? What's your risk appetite?
I mean, the interesting question is when Jamie Dimon bought WaMu at the request of everybody.
Right.
Did he look at what the downside could be?
Let's stick with this for a second. We can go back to that. Yes.
You had raised or brought up the issue as to what competition might be doing.
Right.
And especially in this particular scenario, it seems to me the amount of risk you would be willing to accept, or the losses that you would put, or the bottom line you put at risk, would be materially affected by what your assessment of the competition's response to various unknown information.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, HSBC.
Maybe your 30% could become 60%.
Right, but
if you did certain things.
Excellent point. HSBC has been there for 100 years and they're not going anywhere. And if we pull out, they're going to take our share.
Well, I assume this was HSBC.
No, this was Citi. Okay, but but the question is, we have $1 billion on the table, board. Are we willing to accept $1 billion loss in Hong Kong? What we're saying is, let's put the pedal to the metal, let's keep our share and grow our share, okay? And we're willing to take $1 billion on the chin. That's our risk appetite. Does everybody agree with that?
Not really.
Okay.
The follow-up question might be, how are you mitigating that risk? How are you hedging against it? How are you trying to minimize it?
Okay.
Because it's a certain gross risk, mm-hmm. but then the question is, what's your net risk after it's been... After
so it's really defined? Hard. It's really hard to mitigate this risk because it's a sovereign risk. The Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the U.S. dollar, so you can't really do it from a currency perspective. So you really can't hedge it. It really comes down to a business risk. You know, you have the strategic implication on one side, and you have the loss on the other side if things don't work out. So what number do you feel is the right number?
So I want to know what the upside risk is.
Upside risk is I could go to $1 billion. I could make $1 billion. I could take my market share, you know, I could bring it to 60%. I could, or 45 or 50%. I'm making $200 million. I could go to $500 million, maybe $600-700 million, and maybe eventually to $1 billion. It could be $1 billion business for me over time.
And use it as a launch pad into.
And use that as a launch pad into the rest of Asia. I mean, as a big launch pad. So how do I think about my risk appetite?
What's the probability that negative things happen?
Say again?
What's the probability of the negative things happening? Put some numbers around that.
Oh, so we want to do it based on probability. So if we did it that way, we'd say, okay, there's probably about low probability that things are going to get shaken up with the Chinese coming in because it's not in really in their best interest. So we put a probability of 20%, right? So if $200 million earnings thing, 20%, okay, not that big, $40 million, probability of a downside. Maybe the probability on the upside is about 40-50%. So you have upside. Your point is, you have upside, so let's go for the risk. That's what you're really saying. Sounds.
If the numbers play out,
sounds okay.
You don't want to do that on a napkin.
Okay, we can put the pencil to the paper and come up with those numbers, but feels like, okay, there's an upside here, upside's bigger than the downside, I'm willing to do it. These are all very, very interesting points because these are the kinds of things you need to discuss at the board. What's the strategic implications of the risk that I'm assuming? You know, what's my risk versus my reward? Okay, what's my downside? What's my upside? All very good questions. But still, no one has come back, only Charlie has come back and said, I'm taking $1 billion. That's what my risk appetite is. Okay, so I'm gonna stop and I'm gonna tell you what happened. Okay, so I sat in the room and the discussion went around the table and very senior people in the room and all had very similar ideas. But you know what it came down to? Believe this or not, what is the risk? Okay, what is the number that if we read it about it in a Wall Street Journal, we would be embarrassed about? That's what it came out to, okay? What would we be embarrassed about as a board? Okay, and the number happened to come out to $200 million. And all of these factors came in, but our gut, how we felt about it, was a sense of embarrassment. Now, that doesn't happen at all the time, but I just want to give you a sense of, as a board, what you should be thinking about, okay, and the questions that you should be asking, which are all right, all the right questions, but and how to frame it, how to frame the discussion. You know, it's not just, okay, should we do this, should we didn't do it? No, you know, what are the issues? What are the strategic implications? How does risk, you know, come into that? Okay, and what is our appetite? How do we feel about this? Forget about all the fancy reports. Forget about all these things about risk appetite. You know, forget about looking in the past. Think about, you know, driving this company forward. What's coming out in front of you and being comfortable, you know, with the risk that you're about to undertake. Case.
Which by the way, JP Morgan is now embarrassed because they went out and hired children of the leadership elite in China, got caught by the Wall Street Journal, and now we're pulling back their horns.
Right, right. So now we're going to go to case three, and I promise you that I will do case three, and I will be out of here by 10 to 6. All right, case, and I'm just, this is hot off the plane. I just came from Lima, Peru. I was there last night. I flew all night, and I'm here today. This is true.
Okay. I was going to ask a question about the city situation. Are you saying that the embarrassment factor and the way that it came out is the right decision? Or are you?
I tell you what I think. I think there is no right. I think there's no right answer.
Right. But the way that they think about it and say, sit around and say, you know what? What would you be embarrassed by? What would you be embarrassed by? And they come back and say, well, you know, I would be embarrassed if $200 million was a Wall Street Journal. Is that? You saying that that's actually happened, or are we saying that that is an acceptable process by which they make that decision?
Okay, so what I'm saying is...
I just want to understand
So what I'm saying to you is, and it's a very good question, what I'm saying to you is at the end of the day, as a board member, you have to have a gut feel.
That I agree.
And that's the point that I'm trying to make. You have to have a gut feel about what you're willing to take, right? And if that gut feel means, if you could translate that by saying it's the number I'm embarrassed about, that's the right answer. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that, okay?
But the gut feel, I totally agree. Not just on the board, senior management, same thing, right? You can have all kinds of reports and everything, and at the end of the day, you still have to come up with a number, okay, with the strategy that you feel good here. I totally agree. But I'm just saying that, you know, to the extent that we just make a decision based on embarrassment.
No, you don't. No.
But this is about a much broader issue and a much bigger number than just public relations. That might be one of them. And certainly, you know, we don't make. Just go back to fiduciary, you know, duties, right? You know, so part of it is to say, you know, am I being loyal? Am I exercising care? And at the end of the day, I'm making the right decision. That's the fiduciary role that we play. And I think that, you know, the gut feel is extremely important. I totally agree with that because I've seen numbers and numbers and numbers, and we get down the wrong path. And I totally agree. But I'm just saying, you know, in terms of the embarrassment factor, is that the right factor?
No, it's not the only factor. Right. But the point, I hear your point, and it's a good point. The only thing that I'm trying to say is at the end of the day, if you put all the facts on the table, if you put all of these ideas on the table and you have an intelligent discussion and you chew on it, and at the end of the day say, you know, based on all of this, all of what we've heard, the strategic implications, you know, what our regulators are going to say, we didn't bring that up, what our regulators are going to say, the impact on our businesses in other areas, the impact on our public relations, this is what I'm willing to accept. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that because what has happened, right? What has happened is that you had a meaningful discussion. Yes, sir.
Let's play with this scenario. Charlie says, I'm okay with $1 billion, you know, losing $1 billion on this. Privately, I'm saying, you know, I would feel embarrassed if it was in the Wall Street Journal that we lost $1 billion. That would make me feel really uncomfortable. But Charlie's put a line in the sand, $1 billion. I don't want to come across like looking like a horse. My number is really $250 million. It's much less. But I don't wanna look publicly to say like I'm a horse. And I could see the question I have is the issue of groupthink at the board of directors. When somebody like Charlie makes a strong public statement, and that sort of drives the rest of the discussion, and then people privately sort of say, actually, that wasn't the number I had in mind, but I wasn't gonna contradict Charlie, or I didn't want to come across like less of a macho guy than Charlie.
If he puts that stake in the ground first, then the rest of the negotiation comes back from the number. You might say, well, I wanted to do 250, yeah, but maybe
the reason I'm asking is that in some of the organizations that we have worked with, and in some of the towns, like even the town of Wayland, you see a dramatic difference in how decisions are made depending on whether or not the vote is public. Mm-hmm. Or the vote is used the Delphi technique, and that the vote is secret. And I'm wondering, what's been your observation at the level of boards that you're dealing with? Does groupthink an issue?
At the level that I deal with, the CEOs are very strong, very opinionated, and the really good ones will allow discussion at the end of the day. And then come out and say, no, this is the way we're going to go. I was at a board meeting yesterday in Lima, Peru, which is the next case, and everybody sat around and talked about it for an hour. At the end of the day, the CEO said, no, this is what I want to do, this is what I'm comfortable with, and everybody went right in line with it.
Right. And I can imagine the scenario right here probably would, you know, get the CFO in and say, well, what is this audit going to look like? Are we going to worry about the 3%? Are we going to worry about the 200 million? What about this year? Can we absorb the 200 million? What about some of the other businesses that we're doing? What are we going to report? That's what I would say, you know, would end up talking about.
So that's a perfect intro into the next case. Let me just go into the next case because I'm conscious of the time. So here I am, I'm a senior advisor to the CEO. I go to Lima, Peru, and what's going on? The sovereign, the Peruvian government has mandatory pension fund. Every employed person in Peru has to have contribute to a mandatory pension fund, and it's four banks that run the money, right? And every of these four banks, they're competing with each other. This particular bank is the largest bank in Peru and considers itself culturally to be the leader, always wants to be the number one player. They have been managing the pension fund, okay? And they have been the leader for the last 7 or 8 years. And now, for the first year, last year, they lagged all the competitors. So they've come up with a strategy that said, look, we can't lag the competitors. So what we're going to do is hug the competitors. We're going to figure out what they're investing in, and we're going to buy it right after they buy it. So we're going to be very close to the competitors. So when all the competitors piled into Japanese equities, okay, they piled in. But not only did they pile in, but they went beyond them because they wanted to beat them. Okay, so they're driving this bus through the rearview mirror and trying to replicate, that's probably the better word, their competitors. And now they're coming out with a new campaign that says, look, we're going to give you peace of mind. Invest with us. We're going to give you peace of mind. You're a marketing person. You can appreciate that, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you come before the board, okay? And this is the discussion. This was the exact discussion that happened yesterday. Okay, board, what are the right questions to ask?
I mean, what is the volatility of your portfolio?
We had an average return of 6%. We came in at 6%. Everybody came in at 8%. We were thoroughly embarrassed, and we started losing market share. And we have always been the number one bank, and it's very hard for us to accept that.
And why do we lose?
Because we didn't follow everybody else. We went out and did what we thought, what we wanted to invest in.
Over a 10-year horizon, what's our relative?
Who cares about it? You know, John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. Who cares about the 10-year horizon? We have market share. We're going to lose it. We're embarrassed by all this. We're the number one bank. We don't come in number four.
Can't we shine in focus? If this firm has always been leaders, so I guess it's 3, 5, 10-year numbers must be very good. So why don't they talk about that and make people think about that, say that skill doesn't appear?
Peruvian people don't look for 8 or 10 years.
Five.
They look for the next day.
Right.
They're not interested in that.
Right. Just like the Chinese. You promise them the next day that you don't use them. The idea is you tell them, look,
but our numbers were 2% less than everybody else, right? We had great numbers for 8 years, right? We lost 10% of the share. We can't do that.
Sure. What was the performance? Do you have any idea?
We were at 6. Everybody else was at 8. We looked terrible.
Talking about the previous year.
Previous year, we beat everybody by 2%. They don't care. What did you do for me today? That's what people want to know. What did you do for me today?
So was there any concern by overbuying on their competition's portfolio structure that they would actually be amplifying their competitors' mistakes as well?
But no, the markets went up last year, so when we overbought, we actually did well. We did better than our competitors.
Why did they change their strategy in the first place? From something that was working well to following the other?
Well, we were really not beating the competitors that much, and you know, and we just promoted the CIO to be the head CIO of our private bank, and we just hired a new CIO. he walked in and he said, wow, we're underperforming. So what he had to do is, he had to do damage control. So he went out, he mimicked every single, you know, found out what everybody else was doing, mimicked them, and he did a little bit more. And we're back in the pack.
And so, if you do that, you're certain to go in the pack, because if you do what the average is doing, there are people doing.
But I can't afford to be way lower than the pack. I can't do that.
My question then would be, should we allow returns to be the driving consideration in our decision process?
What should be, so the board says, great board member says, what should be our objective here, our investment objective? What are we trying to do?
It's the wrong decision process.
Wrong decision process, you mean competition? I'd love to have a business without any competition. Wouldn't that be great? But I have competition, how could I do this?
You can confront the fact that you're responsible for a pension fund and push back and say, we're not in this for the return.
I said to that yesterday morning, so let's say we were in a room with four of us, our four competitors, what would we all say? Let's mimic each other. Let's do the exact same thing, you know? Let's tell each other about it so we don't have this issue. That's what we should be doing? What are we gonna do? What board, give me some guidance here. What should we be doing?
So they're limited to a single strategy?
No, we could do a lot of different strategies. 40% international, 60% our local market. And by the way, I have six great analysts that cover the U.S. market.
Maybe we should find out what the competition is doing. That's not a bad idea. But then try to beat them by adding in areas where we think we have more skills. So our risk would be based off, our starting point would be there, and try to improve that.
So excellent. So your point to me is, hey, look, if you're going to compete where your strengths are, right? And if you're going to take risk where those strengths are, right? Because you'll have better returns and you could take risk. Excellent point. What else?
Shouldn't we just say that we should stick with our strategy? Okay, what is it that we're selling to these people, right? I understand it's hard to deal with next quarter's financials and this year's financials, but at the same time, I would always say, look at what Bank of New England did, when they have all the real estate in one place and they take all of that risk.
So you know what, I hear your point. So you know what I would say to you, I agree with you. There is the right way to do this. I agree with you, and I agree that we should do it the right way. I agree with you, but I can't do it because I got competitors and I gotta run my business in a competitive frame. So how could I just do it the right way? What if I do it the right way and I have losses, huge losses the first year, and new losses the second year? I won't have a business after it.
Because the competitors will blow up.
No, they're not. They're gonna be mimicking each other.
Okay. At the same, they will blow up at some point in time.
So you're saying something else. What you're saying to me is that what they're doing is not sustainable, right? Is not sustainable. Okay. So what kind of strategy should I do? What would you suggest?
Just like you said, play with our strength.
Okay, so I'm going to play with my strength is one, but what else am I going to do about this competitive frame? What am I going to do about it? If it's so important, what should I do?
Well, inform the marketplace.
What?
Inform the marketplace. You got to tell them that they're going to lose their money in the other banks. But it's safe with you.
You're going to do an advertising campaign that says, don't invest with them because they're going to lose the money.
Yeah, you're going to market yourself as being a more thoughtful competitor and focusing
thoughtful.
On longer-term reasons.
But what do I do about this competitive business? How do I get over that? How do I get over that?
I'm sorry.
How do I get over this?
Bring your customer into the decision process.
My customer is a lonely worker on this. He has no idea what he's doing. None. He's just looking at his return. So let me just give you the answer because we're running out of time. But you've had very, very good thoughts. The idea is, look, if that's so important to you, use it as one benchmark. Go ahead and do what's right. Think about an overall strategy as what you an overall asset allocation about what you think the world is going to go to, okay? And then within that asset allocation, okay, look at the benchmarks for those areas which you're competing with them, okay? And hug the benchmark and take those risks where you that go with your view. And then over time, you'll become a leader. You won't be looking in the rearview mirror, you'll be moving forward, okay? And you'll be doing it the right way, okay? So that's sort of some of the questions, and that's sort of some of the answers, and that's sort of how the strategy fits in, okay? Now, I said I would finish at 10 of 6.
It's 10 of 6, but you don't have to finish.
But I want to open it up. Those are two cases. I just want to do one other case very quickly, because I find that to be fascinating. And it's really the case of, and it happened to me at AllianceBernstein, where we had huge, you know, if you're a large cap manager and you know you have a lot of money to invest, you're going to take big positions. So the question becomes, how high is up? You go and you take these positions. You buy 32. Funny story. When I first got to the company, there was a star portfolio manager, and we owned 32% of what was the airline that went bust? I forgot the name. We own 32% of a major airline.
American went bust.
And I said to the star portfolio manager, I don't get this. The pilots own 50% of this company. There's not a lot of shares out there. If the thing goes up three times, it gets lost in the rounding. So it's such a huge portfolio. If it goes down, we're in the Wall Street Journal. Why would I want to own this? And he said to me, David, you don't understand. Airlines go up in the summertime. And then 3 weeks later, he sold his position. But the point that I want to make is, how high is up? Here you have a situation where you're buying securities, okay? And someone could say to you, look, I'm supposed to do the best thing for my customer. If I think this is my best idea, I should give it to the customer. Why should I limit? And once I reach the limit, how do I ration out that limit? Okay? And so why should I go up? How high is up? So you could come back and say, okay, based on the discussion that we had, how high are you comfortable if you have a loss? How would you have a loss? The loss would be based on what the diminution in price would be to get out of the position, right?
Which is, if you look at these deflating bubbles, one of the faultiest assumptions in the risk models that most investment managers use is that there's perfect liquidity in the market. In the real world is, when you're 98% long and 2% short, which is what the market is, if you want to sell, there is no buyer. And the discount to sell is not, there is no liquidity. 1987 crash, the concept of portfolio insurance. So short the future, as the market starts to go down, what happens? You end up in an elevator shaft.
Charlie, I'm not disputing you that. I'm not disputing you that you have to take into account liquidity. I have to do, but as a board, I think the point here is, where are the boundaries? You know, I always say this is like when you go bowling. When I went bowling when I was younger, there were no these bumper stickers that came up. You can't throw a gutter ball anymore. You know, it stays in a lane. And when you go to your risk management team as a board member and you look at risk, you want to make sure that the ball stays in the lane. You want to make sure that, you know, you're taking appropriate risks with the extent and the tolerance level that you have, and that you can sleep better at night because there's processes and controls surrounding them, okay, that give you an indication when things are not going the way they should be going. And you have these tripwires, you have these early warning signals, and you don't get embarrassed. And there's a process behind it. And that's what you want to see. You don't want, it's okay to look at the numbers, it's okay to look at the quantitative detail, but I tell you, as a quant, okay, it's just one input into a decision-making process, and that the really you as board have brain, not brains, but judgment. And at the end of the day, that's what you need to exercise, your good judgment. And if you walk away from this meeting tonight with anything, just rely on your judgment. It will reward you dramatically. I'll take questions. Anybody have any issues? Any thoughts? Go ahead. Mike, go ahead.
I was just going to make one observation. I think it comes out in this case as well. Joe before brought up the issue of fiduciary concern. You were talking about the reality of dealing, you know, with the people, and I think that is one of the juxtapositions, is the behavioral considerations versus the fiduciary considerations in being able to accomplish something. And here it is again. You've got portfolio managers that are teeing up anecdotal evidence versus a robust study of what have these portfolios actually done over the last 10 years at various concentration thresholds. I was at a firm where this very issue came up, and that's ultimately how it got analyzed, and lo and behold, the anecdotal went up in smoke because it couldn't support what the manager's experience has been, because their experience was not the same experience as existed in the history of the portfolio. But my point is, when you study these problems, you can't look at them as rational decision-making exercises. You have to look at the cognitive errors and the behavioral considerations, the filters on information, both in forming the problem, selecting alternatives, and being able to implement anything.
So that comes up in a discussion of what I would call culture, okay? And I think it's very important within a company to have the proper risk culture. Now let me give you an example of how I think about it. Whenever we made a customer error, the first question I asked always was, how do we make the customer whole? How do we make the customer whole? And I got news for you, the numbers were huge off the chart, but I wanted to know, how do we make the customer whole? That created a certain kind of thought process about how we went ahead and conducted business.
Right.
Yes.
I want to make sure that everybody in this room is aware that David has written two books. One is a sort of classic, well-written book on the nature of risk. The second is a fascinating book for any of you that are teaching crisis management like Jamie, or who are on boards of nonprofit companies there where some of the board members may not really sort of understand risk. It is a perfectly charming fable about animals in the woods. And how, and he sets up with this delightful story about how the animals are dealing with the potential threat of fire and what they do. And then he sort of ties it together about risk management and how different people deal with risk. So if any of you are on boards or know boards where kind of the issue risk seems very complicated, a little off-putting, and rather not discuss it, or even worse, it's not something we understand until we give it to the risk managers who understand, when they tell us what to do and we say yes. This is a wonderful sort of board retreat book to read and then discuss.
Thank you.
So my compliments to David for putting it together. It's on Amazon.com.
Thank you.
Janie, you had a comment you were going to make earlier.
Larry, what's the name of the book?
The Nature of Risk. The Nature of Risk.
The Nature of Risk.
Are there other comments or questions? I want to make a comment. I was not at all surprised to hear you say that the decision was made on the basis of what would be the embarrassing headline in the Wall Street Journal. That did not surprise me at all, because I think a lot of decisions are made that way. It's been documented that executives behave themselves by asking themselves the question, if my children heard about this on the evening news, how would I feel? That keeps their behavior in mind. I was also reminded of a saying of one of my ethics professors in my education long ago. He said, sometimes, you know, you have to abandon principles and do the right thing. So I wasn't surprised to hear that at all.
Nice comment.
Well, I mean, I think that's interesting where there's a moral element to the question. But when it's a financial one, I was a little bit curious, because a lot of the things that we spoke about can be modeled. You know, I mean, you can do linear regression analysis and you can come up with statistical likelihoods of certain outcomes, even for social political events. So I'm wondering about when a recommendation is presented, you know, the likelihood of X is 25%, and we think the outcome will be Y. I wonder, is it your experience that boards tend to be more conservative or than the statistics would indicate, or more risk-taking?
I'd say it way differently, and I think this really said it best. There are lies, damn lies, and then the statistics. I really...
Mark Twain.
Was it Mark Twain?
I think so.
Okay. What?
This is a question not for you, but for everybody in the room. There was a fascinating study several years ago on risk-taking in trading rooms. There are very few women who are traders. And you get this kind of situation where the testosterone is starting to flow, mm-hmm. and everybody wants to pile up a deal and not want to be left out of the deal, and not being want to be perceived as kind of a weakling. and sometimes I've seen that same dynamics in boardrooms, particularly when there's lots of guys there. And I've seen the same dynamics where there's lots of guys and maybe one woman. I'm wondering if any of you, and not just David, but any of you, have observed, is there a different attitude towards risk when you have two or three women on a board, as opposed to all men, or maybe all men and just one token woman? Would that make a difference? Because the article would basically say some of the dysfunctionalities in trading comes because it's all guys.
I actually ran a trading floor. There is a lot of, you don't see a lot of young people on a trading floor because they get burnt out after a while.
Old people, you mean?
I mean, you don't see any old people, right.
They're the managers.
I think at the end of the day with trading, and I'm going to go back to what you said because you said it's something very thoughtful. The way you manage traders, interesting enough, is you have stop points.
Right.
That you get to a certain point, stop, we have a timeout, we discuss it with your manager, you get to another stop point, you know, guess what, your positions are frozen, guess what, you have next another stop point, you liquidate them. That's how, if you go to any major hedge fund, that's really how, you know, the risk management works. And they're based on the models that you're talking about. They're based on what the potential losses. So I think my only point with what I was trying to say is that you can make the model any way you want it if you're really good at it, but it's an input and it's a good input. To get to your point, look, I'll tell you an interesting story. Lehman was about to blow, and Lehman was AllianceBernstein's major trading partner, and I've been through Latin America. I reorganized in a lot of, with Bill Rose, a lot of Latin American countries. I know a bankrupt company when I see one, okay? And I just got up one day, 3 days before Lehman blew, and I said, gentlemen, we are out. We are out of Lehman as a counterparty. And Lehman was our major counterparty. Major counterparty. And I took a lot of heat. A lot of heat that day. And but I said, guys, we are out. And 3 days later, it blew. And when I wrote when Jerry Lieberman, the president of AllianceBernstein, wrote my fitness report, my personnel report, he wrote I was courageous in the report. The point that I'm trying to make is that someone has to. I mean, there is a herd mentality, but if you want to be successful at this, you got to put the stake in the ground and say, I'm drawing my line in the sand. This is how I'm going to manage this. And if you don't do that, okay, the water just takes you in, it just takes you into the ocean.
And with that, we have to say at 6 o'clock. Wow. And that's okay. A soft landing. You're welcome to stay around and say hello.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
And continue talking.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for saying. Thank you. Thank you for your expertise.
No, good stories.
It's interesting. The city, Hong Kong. My sister was a young partner, a chairman, Hong Kong, on the transition.
Very interesting. Very nice. Thank you. Thank you for your comments.
Those are great stories. But I mean, I would assume that the whole issue in Hong Kong
was what happens to the rest of Asia. They pulled out.
City, their international business is their business.
You had it right, Charlie.
We have an unspoken
agreement.
I
mean, it's more embarrassing for Jamie Dimon today for what they did in Asia.
Absolutely.
Advising the board on how they can set up with their governor. So they're brand new.
I got to catch an airplane.
They structured themselves.
Nice. I hope you enjoyed it. I tried.
Very much enjoyed it. Not my area of expertise, but I found
that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great.
Thank you.
Pleasure to meet you. Good to meet you.
Yes, I enjoyed your comments, really.
Well, I didn't make that many. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fabulous. I'm going to send you an email to thank you, but I'm also going to ask you to send me the email version of the cases.